Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press. We publish news, analysis, and perspectives on issues at the intersection of tech and democracy. In the United States, polling shows a broad bipartisan appetite for AI regulation. An Annenberg Public Policy Center survey conducted earlier this year found 65% of Americans say the government has done too little to regulate AI, including 77% of Democrats and 53% of Republicans. On June 4th, Representatives Jay Obernolte, a Republican from California, and Lori Trahan, a Democrat from Massachusetts, released a 269-page bipartisan discussion draft of a bill called the Great American Artificial Intelligence Act of 2026. On the same date, they published an opinion in Bloomberg Law, explicitly calling for feedback on the draft. They wrote that, quote, "This discussion draft isn't a final product. It's the start of a serious national conversation with workers, researchers, startups, frontier labs, educators, civil society, state leaders, and the American people," unquote. The bill is organized into four titles, including Frontier AI Governance, Workforce, Cybersecurity, and Research, Development, and International Cooperation. It would create the first comprehensive federal AI governance regime in the United States. If it became law, the bill would create binding federal development obligations for large frontier developers, defined as companies with more than $500 million in annual revenue that have trained a frontier model. This threshold would capture firms like OpenAI, Anthropic, Google, Meta, and xAI. As analysts at the law firm DLA Piper point out, these provisions appear to draw on frontier model laws developed in California, New York, and Illinois. The draft addresses a range of other issues, including transparency and whistleblower protections. It takes on AI fraud deterrence and cybersecurity. It has a section on free speech that would mandate a study and legislative recommendations on jawboning of AI firms and censorship. It supports workforce development and research to better understand the impacts of AI on the labor market. And the fourth title of the bill contains provisions related to research and development, public data for artificial intelligence systems, and international cooperation on AI governance, which would include advancing American leadership on standards. The bill would preempt state laws specifically regulating the development of AI models, including training, weighting, and evaluation, on a three-year sunset, while explicitly preserving state laws of general applicability and state authority over activities occurring at or after a model's deployment. Reaction to the preemption measure drew immediate scrutiny from a variety of civil society organizations and advocates, including Public Citizen, Public Knowledge, and the AFL-CIO. Early supporters of the draft include the Business Software Alliance and the Information Technology Industry Council. In Congress, the discussion draft was supported by Representative Suhas Subramaniam, a Democrat from Virginia, Scott Franklin, a Republican from Florida, Scott Peters, a Democrat from California, and Aaron Houchin, a Republican from Indiana. Notably, the co-chairs of the House Commission on AI and the Innovation Economy, including Representative Ted Lieu, a Democrat from California, who served as Representative Obernolte's co-chair on the bipartisan House Task Force on Artificial Intelligence in 2024, said the draft, quote, "cannot serve as the basis for productive dialogue." To learn more about the draft and their goals for it, I invited Representatives Trahan and Obernolte to the podcast. Congresswoman Trahan was able to speak to me on Wednesday. She's been a leading congressional voice on platform transparency, advancing bills like the Social Media Data Act and the Digital Services Oversight and Safety Act, or DSOSA, which was a similarly ambitious piece of legislation floated in 2022. Let's jump right in.
My name is Lori Trahan. I represent Massachusetts 3rd District.
Congresswoman, I'm pleased that you're able to join me again on the Tech Policy Press podcast. We've talked before about other legislative proposals that you have put forward, your office, and you have become known for taking big swings at comprehensive solutions to big problems. I think about DSOSA, if we can cast our minds back to the moment when you put that out, a very ambitious, comprehensive plan, particularly around social media. Now you're swinging at artificial intelligence, literally with something called the Great American Artificial Intelligence Act of 2026, with your colleague across the aisle, Representative Jay Obernolte. Can I just ask for a second to step back, maybe from the specifics of this, and ask if in your mind you have a kind of concept or vision of what artificial intelligence means for the United States, what we need to do in order to properly regulate this technology?
Yeah, well, I think big picture, I mean, artificial intelligence is going to be one of those transformative technologies that changes everything about our life and how we, you know, live, how we work. And there's enormous promise that comes with that. I come from Massachusetts. So there's AI, you know, being deployed or thought of in the cure and the treatment space for healthcare. But I think what Mythos just demonstrated in an instant is it comes with enormous risk. You know, what I get frustrated by as a member of Congress is when we don't keep up with things that we know are progressing on an accelerated path. It's like Congress doesn't change its ability to pass laws or to establish any sort of governance. And we've seen this before. I've always taken the foundational step of putting transparency, reporting, in this case, auditing, because I feel like you can embark on a whole host of other policy areas once you know, or once you have visibility into these models, these algorithms, data, whatever it might be, which is why, you know, we worked with DeSosa early on in our career and now working on artificial intelligence. So look, I think AI is going to be the most consequential technology of our generation. And I don't think that's an exaggeration. There's still time to govern it democratically before we cede the future entirely to the private sector or to our foreign adversaries. And that is the bet that we're making with this bill.
You know, of course, this comes out as a bipartisan proposal. You've obviously had to make, you know, multiple trade-offs going into this. The most key one, I would reckon, is around preemption. A lot of folks in your own party unhappy with this particular approach. Is there a case for preemption that you would make here that you effectively, you know, what won you over on being willing to sign on to this preemption mechanic in this particular proposal?
So I'm going to answer that question, but I just want to start, just like I started with my negotiation with Congressman Obernolte, we didn't start with preemption. And so I'm just going to level set for your listeners and really start by saying something directly to them. We published this bill as a discussion draft because we genuinely want to hear from folks like you, the researchers, the advocates, the civil society groups in this audience. That's exactly who this process is designed for. And this is an opening bid, not a final answer. This draft, is comprehensive, it's preliminary, and it's narrowly tailored all at once. It's not the one AI framework to rule them all. What it is a focused effort on is tackling catastrophic risks and near-term workforce impacts from frontier AI development without strangling the innovative potential of this technology. And it is designed to equip the federal government with the reporting infrastructure and the technical capacity it needs to govern AI, you know, with evidence-driven policy in the years ahead. And so I know we'll get into talking about the specifics of the bill and the governance structure that we put in place, but I'll go to the issue of preemption. I've heard the criticism on the preemption language in the bill, and I take it seriously. I mean, look, I've spent years fighting for the exact kinds of state-level accountability mechanisms that people in your audience are worried about losing, and I'm not going to dismiss that concern. But here's my bottom line on preemption, and I'll just say it plainly. I will preempt, but only if we're setting the strongest possible federal standard. A preemption provision in a bill with no meaningful federal standard is a moratorium, and I won't sign on to that. So what is the federal lane? You know, generally speaking, frontier model development, not products, not deployment, not use. The model itself, the weights and architecture trained on petabytes of data, on hundreds of thousands of chips. That's the layer where a single federal standard makes sense. The red line that I've held throughout the entire process, states retain full authority to regulate AI at the deployment and the use stage. That is where AI systems actually interact with real people, whether it's housing decisions, hiring, healthcare, credit. States keep their teeth where enforcement is most tangible. The guardrails in the preemption provision are non-negotiable. The savings clauses explicitly preserve laws of general applicability, privacy, consumer protection, anti-discrimination, civil rights, the common law in full. So the cases against Meta and OpenAI proceed, and any law regulating activities that occur upon or after a model is released, including the design of AI systems, their deployment, and their use by end consumers. And critically, there's a sunset. Preemption expires in December 2029, assuming passage later this year. And that's designed to be a forcing function that prevents Congress from doing what we did with Section 230. And that's implementing a policy and then never being required to seriously evaluate whether it's working. And the sunset forces us back to the table. Now, of course, I also expect Congress to continue to regulate frontier AI in the years to come, even while the preemption is in effect. These are initial policies that represent a starting point, a foundation for future regulation, and I think they preserve optionality as the technology quickly evolves.
Listening to some of those folks that you reference who've already kind of come out suggesting their concerns around preemption in particular, I mean, I think they're really concerned about where the line is drawn, right? When a state wants to regulate a AI companion app that's harming minors, you know, does it have to regulate the deployer, leave the model developer untouched? You know, where is this line from your perspective? How do you believe that state law would function under this bill?
Yes, and we want it to. I mean, look, this is a difficult balance to strike, and I'll be the first one to acknowledge that. You know, if there are genuine ambiguities in the text that could swallow state consumer protection law or civil rights enforcement, that's a problem I want to fix, right? That's literally why we published a draft. Come tell us where the language fails. Drawing a clean line between AI model development and AI systems built on those models is genuinely difficult to do in legislative text. I know that. But I don't accept the argument that it's impossible. Laws across the country already leverage the developer-deployer distinction. The EU AI Act has specific regulations for general-purpose AI models. Legislators draw hard lines every day. That's the job. My sunset, combined with the savings clauses, is specifically designed to correct for the places where we draw that line imperfectly. And I'll just bring up one more thing. If you tell me the transparency auditing and verification provisions don't go far enough, just name me the additional policies. We will take them under serious consideration. What I won't accept are mechanisms that are either prone to First Amendment challenges or that are simply bad policy dressed up as accountability. But this is a moment where we want to hear from folks so that we can make the product better.
What do you regard as this period, this feedback solicitation you're doing? You've got this out as a discussion draft. You want to have this dialogue. What do you see as the sort of revision path? And are there specific activities or engagements that you're planning that would, you know, help along that way?
So first and foremost, I mean, it's only been out for a week now. We already have collected a lot of great feedback. And with our release, we put, you know, the email address where people can contact us, so that we can start to distill that. It obviously falls in a couple of key buckets. But, you know, we encourage more creative ideas and thinking around this. And then, you know, we'd love to do roundtables, you know, probably the week after next when we come back into session. You know, we'd love to surface, you know, some of the feedback that we've received and have an open dialogue on the ones that we're, you know, trying to incorporate into legislative text and maybe the ones where, you know, we feel as though the text already covers or whatever it might be, but we want to have an open and transparent process and certainly work with our Republican co-lead on, you know, getting the bill into a better position with a coalition before we file it. And I don't put a time, I don't put definitive deadlines around that because, you know, we really want to make sure that we're keeping it open for as long as we're getting that feedback.
want to ask just about the broader kind of political context in which this is happening. I mean, we're seeing, you know, poll after poll that suggests, you know, extraordinary concern among the American public, really in, you know, cross political aisle about artificial intelligence, more and more concern about the infrastructure required to, you know, run artificial intelligence, the data center battles that we're seeing spread out in communities across the country, including in Massachusetts. There's a set of fears that the public have about the intent of the corporations and, in effect, I think also the intent of the federal government around this. What do you make of this political moment, how a bill like this would either will calm or potentially add to that discourse?
Look, I think that people are fearful of how AI is going to disrupt or maybe displace them in, you know, a career that they've spent years in. And there's also just a fear of the unknown. But when I'm back home, folks that I talk to, they want us to take a serious effort on this. They know instinctively it needs to be bipartisan. They know that it can't fall victim to the gridlock that has defined Washington for too many years. They're appreciative that I'm working on this. They know that I'm not a shill for big tech. They know that the risk of doing nothing or Congress falling into the traps of gridlock or too much divisiveness will lead to the same thing that they saw with social media. And that's these big, large, you know, private, mostly private companies setting the rules of the road. And that is, I think, what they would find unacceptable. So I do think even in these early stages, it is really important to have open conversations about people's fears, about their concerns, about what their expectations are for governance, and that we're going to get ahead of this and keep up with it so that it doesn't cause, you know, unnecessary harms that are really being discussed broadly today. I mean, look, my dad was a union iron worker. I grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts. That's a city built by people who worked with their hands. And so I know what a bad transition to a transformative technology looks like. It doesn't just displace workers. It hollows out communities. Automation and offshoring really did close all the mills that were responsible for the Industrial Revolution in my region of the state of Massachusetts. So I understand those fears and those concerns in my core. And I'm not going to sit here in Congress and allow inaction that will literally allow the largest AI companies to fill the void with what they think is best for the future of technology.
You mentioned, you know, unions and labor. I mean, in particular, I mean, those are some of the groups that have come out, I suppose, swinging against this draft just at the outset. Is there a specific message you have from them, the type of engagement you'd like to see from labor groups, the AFL-CIO, AFT, communications workers, et cetera?
Absolutely. I mean, so labor is not a monolith, right? So we're talking with all corners of labor to, you know, get their feedback, to address some of the concerns or the gaps that they believe may exist. And, you know, look, I'm honest with the problem Congress faces. Frontier AI is diffusing throughout the economy, but it isn't clearly showing up in the jobs data yet, right? New graduates are facing record unemployment that correlates with advances in AI, but the causal link isn't proven, right? At the same time, the CEOs of these companies are going on talk shows predicting, you know, mass displacement by 2030. Like, what is Congress supposed to do with that information? And my answer is you can't make sound workforce and tax policy without accurate data. So before we reform the safety net or the tax code, we need to understand what's actually happening. And that's what Title II does. Title II starts to do, right? The Labor Department must establish an AI workforce research hub within 90 days to study AI's actual effects on workers, run the scenario planning, and generate actionable policy insights. We update the WARN Act. When AI is a substantial factor in a mass layoff, employers must say so in their 60-day notice, specifying what AI was used, estimating how many jobs it cost, and describing what retraining they offered, if any, right? Workers deserve to know why they lost their jobs. And then finally, we modernize federal data collection. We revise federal surveys to actually capture AI adoption and workforce impacts. We run prize competitions to develop reproducible benchmarks for measuring what AI can automate. And we build a job flow tracking program for at least 15 AI-sensitive occupations. And then we study a rapid AI adjustment assistance program modeled on trade adjustment assistance for workers displaced by AI. We're not prejudging what that program looks like, but we're not going to wait until the displacement hits the middle class to start designing the response. And so I think the workforce provisions in this bill are a labor argument, not a Chamber of Commerce argument. I mean, the question isn't whether AI changes work. It's whether workers have any power in how that change happens. And I refuse to tell my constituents, workers who lose their jobs, young people who can't find work, that I was waiting for a better opportunity to govern, because we need to start that process today.
Another concern I think some have is that, you know, there are some basics that just aren't in place in this country, including privacy legislation. You know, most of the great harms we can expect and anticipate from artificial intelligence come from a lack of privacy protections. Are there other aspects of the kind of general regulatory environment that would need to change in order to, you know, make this bill work?
Yeah. And I, you know, one of the things that we didn't really just do, and I'm sure many of your listeners already know, sort of the provisions of the bill. I mean, certainly, you know, not having a federal privacy policy in place is just, it's just unacceptable, which is, you know, why, you know, we preserve and, if anything, rely on the privacy actions that states have taken. But I'll be the first one to tell you that, you know, AI action, it has to be accompanied by comprehensive privacy. I mean, we have to rein in data brokers. We've been talking about it for years, and we have not taken the step to pass it. These aren't silos in tech policy. They're all intertwined. So I do think we address some of the regulatory regimes that have to be put in place, but those are likely going to be adjusted over time. You know, one of the reasons why we have a collaborative enforcement model with state AGs is because we want to learn from, you know, enforcement and the best practices going forward. So can I just take a minute to kind of go through sort of what we establish in terms of real federal governance for frontier AI, just so that I can level set on, you know, we've talked about some of the issues or the criticisms, but, you know, it's mandatory transparency. It's independent auditing. It's real-time verification of safety and security procedures. The scope is, you know, deliberately narrow. I'll own that choice. I mean, the federal lane does cover model development, frontier model development, not products, not deployment, not use. You know, we're concentrating regulatory attention at the layer where catastrophic risks originate. That's cybersecurity vulnerabilities, biosecurity risks, loss of control scenarios. That's the layer where uniformity across 50 states makes sense. Of course, within that, you have to define what frontier means in practice. So we're talking about large frontier developers, companies with over $500 million in revenue, though we're still evaluating the right threshold. The two-person startup without a legal team is not in this regime, right? Mid-sized firms, open-weight developers, researchers, they're intentionally kept outside it. So compliance burden falls where the risk actually is. You know, CAISI, right, the Center for AI Standards and Innovation, they get a tenfold funding increase from $15 million to $100 million a year. That agency has to be the credible federal counterpart to the frontier labs. Right now, it just isn't resourced to do the job, but this bill provides the authorization, and Jay and I will have to get the appropriations to match. We include whistleblower protections because the people closest to these systems are often the first to see problems. And if you report a violation of federal AI law, you can't be retaliated against. If you are, you get reinstatement, double back pay with interest, compensatory damages, and attorney's fees. And so I think it's important that, you know, the transparency requirements are specific. You know, we have independent auditing and verification. We use those independent verification or organizations to embed within large frontier developers, perform those ongoing audits, evaluations, and testing. States can opt in to getting those report findings, and so they can refer violations to the AG or to state AGs. This is not a self-certification regime. And so, we're going to figure out what the regulatory regime for steady state needs to be by putting in, something quickly that will give us, data and an independent verification. We're also going to learn around, rulemaking authority that will need to keep pace with the frontier as it moves. So that's sort of how we're thinking about it. Of course, like I always say, we welcome the feedback on whether we can go beyond.
Well, I think that is a message for my listeners to take away, that both your offices are open to feedback, and I'm sure you'll be hearing from many folks in this community. I'm grateful for your time. I hope perhaps as this continues to develop, we'll have a chance to talk about it again.
I'd love that, Justin. Thank you so much.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to my guest, thanks to my co-founder Brian Jones, and thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Press.